The following is for your ears only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog, and we have newsmakers, experts, and top reporters to bring you these stories.
Back to Iraq. Obama orders up to 300 special forces to advise and assist against an al-Qaeda-inspired terror tide, but agrees it's not enough.
The Iran factor. What is the major power in the region already doing in Iraq? What coordination with the U.S. is likely, and what about the nuclear issue?
Deportation consternation. After the immigration issue helped sink a key GOP House leader, what hope for reform and for more executive action?
Oz and ad scams. TV's Dr. Oz comes under fire on Capitol Hill over weight loss claims, shedding light on questionable marketing in many media.
A very Margaret memorial. The late singer Margaret Whiting is celebrated by a multitude of voices with songs that she loved, many by her own dad.
Plus notable quotes from last week's news.
All that and more for your ears only, now a project of the nonprofit New York Foundation for the Arts. For your ears only, for the week of June 22nd and the first full day of summer, I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote. This procedure is totally illegitimate and not acceptable for us. The people of Afghanistan will make their own decisions. That was Afghan presidential candidate Abdullah Abdullah, leader in the election's first round, rejecting a second-round tally by the nation's election commission after his complaints about voting irregularities were ignored. Now this.
It's not just Iraq, but it's a whole pattern of behavior over the last 6 years that has refused to recognize that there is a war on terror, that we've got to move very aggressively to be able to deal with that, and this administration has repeatedly demonstrated that they don't believe it.
We have had advisors in Iraq through our embassy, and we're prepared to send a small number of additional American military advisors, up to 300, to assess how we can best train, advise, and support Iraqi security forces going forward.
Former Vice President Dick Cheney last week led a reanimation of Bush-era hawks, critical of Barack Obama for ending their 10-year war in Iraq too soon, for not doing more for the new war in Syria, and thus for encouraging a terrorist tide now sweeping toward Baghdad. With predictably grim reluctance, the president finally ordered a modest special forces mission back to Iraq, while warning that only a comprehensive political settlement there could even begin to establish a long-term peace among long-hostile Sunni, Shiite, and Kurdish populations.
To consider the short-term military mission, the ingredients for long-term peace, and related questions about Iran, threats to the U.S. homeland, and more, we're joined again by retired Army Colonel Douglas McGregor, a decorated veteran of the First Gulf War. He's now a strategic consultant and Ph.D. author of 5 books on military strategy and reform. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Does a force of 300 elite special forces fighters suggest simply an assessment mission or inevitable boots-on-the-ground advice and assistance for such Iraqi troops that have not yet fled forces of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, ISIS and their local Sunni allies? And what do you see the GIs actually doing?
Well, we're told that we were told initially, at any rate, that the 300 would be what the president described, but in the last few days, other members of the White House staff have told members of the press that, in fact, these 300 will constitute intelligence cells designed to provide targeting information. And there was even a discussion of executing attacks with unmanned aerial vehicles, what some people refer to as drones, all the way up into Syria. So that certainly suggests mission creep on a scale that the president did not admit to.
The president himself has warned of possible manned or unmanned airstrikes, at least to defend Baghdad, as they did to protect Benghazi during Libya's revolution. We know what happened there more recently. What effectiveness do you see for airstrikes, given the situation in Iraq now?
Not very much. First of all, I think we all need to keep in mind that we created the current catastrophe. We installed the Arab Shiite dictatorship that Mr. Maliki presides over. Mr. Maliki was always Iran's candidate. And effectively, we've created a Shiite Arab state that is allied with Iran, a beachhead for Iranian strategic power and influence. All of the Sunni Arabs and Turks in the region want to destroy it. So now we propose to go back in after having created this disaster and ally ourselves ostensibly with Iran and Iranian influence to preserve this Shiite Arab state. It doesn't make a great deal of sense strategically for us at all.
Has ISIS taken a page out of the General Petraeus playbook by building support from Sunni tribal leaders, as he did? And could those leaders shake off ISIS if they unseat today's Shiite leadership in Baghdad and win what they consider a fair share of power and resources?
Well, Petraeus bought the Sunni Arab leaders with almost $1 billion in cash. ISIS isn't buying up anybody. They simply came in and were rapidly expanded in terms of size and strength by the Sunni Arab tribes that were all anti-Shiite and wanted to boot the Shiites out of their particular region. And that's one of the reasons ISIS made such rapid progress. ISIS is not likely to enjoy the kind of strength that it's had thus far for very long, though, because they've already fallen into the bad habit of decapitating people and implementing Sharia law, which is, frankly, not terribly popular among most Sunni Arabs in Iraq.
Do you see Iraq inevitably breaking into Sunni, Shiite, and Kurdish enclaves or actual separate states?
Well, that was really the product of the surge. More than anything else, the Shiite Sunni civil war was over in December of 2006. Baghdad had been converted to a largely Shiite city. Then Petraeus came in and began the surge with a 200% increase in airstrikes. We killed large numbers of Sunnis and effectively completed the process of installing Mr. Maliki in the Iranian regime. So what we're seeing now really is a backlash to that, but not much is likely to change. The ISIS enjoys success largely because it's in a Sunni area. I don't think it's going to have much success pushing further south. So to answer your question, this country has been divided since the surge, and what we're seeing happen today, both in the Kurdish north and the center with the Sunni Arabs and in the south with the Shiite, is essentially a consolidation of something that's already a reality on the ground.
On TV last week, you said the Israelis have an interesting viewpoint on sectarian struggles as we see now in Iraq. Talk about that.
Well, I think we need to keep in mind that both the Shiite Islamists and the Sunni Islamists hate Christians and Jews. If they can kill Christians and Jews, they do so and have done so. They are anti-American, they are anti-European, they're anti-Israeli. So from the standpoint of the Israelis, if your two enemies are involved in killing each other, it's folly to interfere and stop the process. It's even dumber to align yourself with one or the other. I mean, we need to stop and consider that just last year, Mr. Obama wanted to attack the Syrian army and its government that is allied with Iran on behalf of some of the same people who are now in central Iraq trying to kill Shiites. This year, he wants to attack the Sunni Islamists that last year he was prepared to support and align himself with Iran. This is not a national security strategy. This is a Monty Python episode.
Talk more about the Iran factor, what its forces are doing now in Iraq, what prospects you see for coordination with U.S. plans and operations, and maybe some greater cooperation going forward.
I'm not sure that we're going to buy much in terms of cooperation from Iran for anything that we do. We're simply welcomed as useful fools in the terms that Lenin thought of the West. What you're seeing happen in Iraq is predictable. The Iranians are not going to allow the Shiite state that dominates Baghdad and southern Iraq to fall into the hands of the Sunnis. They are going to defend their beachhead. Their beachhead through Iraq touches Saudi Arabia. Eastern Saudi Arabia has large numbers of Shiites. That's one of the reasons the Saudis are so determined to destroy this state. You have the same problem in Qatar, the same problem in Kuwait. The Emirates want to destroy the Shiite state. The Turks loathe and hate Mr. Maliki and the Shiites in Iran. This is a larger regional conflict that has very little to do with us. We certainly set it in motion through our intervention and occupation in Iraq, but this is not our fight. Men in pickup trucks with machine guns running around in open stretches of wasteland, desert, and I have been to these places, there is nothing there, are meaningless to us.
Retired Army Colonel Douglas McGregor is a decorated veteran of the First Gulf War, now a strategic consultant and PhD author of 5 books on military strategy and reform.
Quote from the news, I remember them yelling, you're going to make it, you're going to make it. I just kept trying to tell them I was going to die. That was former Marine Corporal William Kiley Carpenter on the near fatal wounds he received from throwing his body on a grenade to save a buddy in Afghanistan, and for which last week he received the Medal of Honor.
Next, more on Iran, in Iraq, the ongoing nuclear talks, and more. For your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. Sitting here listening to this testimony, I don't believe it. No one believes it. That was House Republican Paul Ryan after IRS Commissioner John Koskinen said a computer crash has permanently eliminated thousands of emails wanted for the continuing probe of alleged partisan treatment of conservative groups seeking nonprofit status. Now this.
We're open to discussions if there's something constructive that can be contributed by Iran, if Iran is prepared to do something that is going to respect the integrity and sovereignty of Iraq.
The Iranians can provide some assets to make sure Baghdad doesn't fall.
The notion of the United States and Iran fighting as allies against Islamist extremist forces sweeping through large areas of Iraq rose last week with remarks by Secretary of State John Kerry and South Carolina's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham. But other GOP leaders saw it as dangerous, dancing with the devil, or worse.
And there were conflicting accounts of how significant a factor the Iraq situation was in ongoing international negotiations over Iran's nuclear program, which ended another phase last week with a Chinese envoy reporting progress registered, though differences may still be too deep to resolve. To consider all the complicated dynamics involved, for your ears only, we're joined again by Abbas Milani, Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
What is your latest understanding of how many forces of what sort Iran already has in Iraq to defend the Shiite regime of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and Shiite holy sites in Najaf and Karbala?
Well, officially, they have only few advisors. But I think de facto, they obviously have had a fairly large amount of assets in there for several years now. These are intelligence assets. These are IRGC commanders who have businesses there, who have front companies there. And by several reports, the commander of the Quds Brigade, Mr. Soleimani, has been in Baghdad coordinating the efforts of the militia, the Shiite militia.
That the Sunni forces of ISIS and its tribal allies in Iraq would threaten Shiite holy sites suggests how far back in the past their division within Islam goes. But we're also told the two sects lived relatively peacefully for long periods of time. Can a current political understanding restore that situation? And could Iraqi Sunni reject the ISIS fighters if the local Sunni got a better share of power and resources from Baghdad?
I would think so. I mean, I think if you look at the history of Islam, the number of times where Shiites and Sunnis have fought, and there have been many instances in the past where they have fought, and they have fought ferociously, but those numbers compared to the times where they have lived together rather amicably is a small.
In Tehran, you've written, radical conservatives have a very different view of the ISIS onslaught that's prompted Washington to send a military mission back to Iraq.
The radical conservatives basically see this ISIS, or Daesh as it's called in Iran, as what they consider to be an Israeli-American creation in order to weaken Iran, in order to weaken Shiism, in order to open the way for America's re-entry into Iraq. I don't think they've been reading Mr. Obama's announcements. They think that America is trying desperately to get back into Iraq, and thus they have helped create, with the money from Saudi Arabia, with logistical support from Turkey, this phenomenon called ISIS. On the other hand, the reformists in Iran don't see it that way. They think that ISIS is just a curse of Sunni anger, that it is a form of radicalism that needs to be contained if it is not to eventually engage Iran and the rest of the Middle East in a sectarian fight that no one, according to the reformists, and I think they're right, no one will benefit from.
So what chance do you see for some degree of cooperation or at least coordination of U.S. and Iranian efforts in Iraq?
I think there's a fairly good chance. And the fact that the Rouhani administration has been trying to reconcile with the United States increases this chance. But you have to remember, this is not the first time the United States and Iran will have been on the same side in fighting Sunni radicalism when the U.S. was preparing to attack Afghanistan, Iran was providing, by all accounts, rather important logistical information, intelligence information, coordinating with the United States, allowing even flyover Iranian territory, agreeing to allow U.S. jets to come into Iranian territory to pick up any soldiers that might have come across.
What is your best understanding of how much discussion of the Iraq situation has taken place at the international negotiations over Iran's nuclear program?
There clearly has been talk. The Iranians admit it. The U.S. Admits it. They have not divulged the extent of the conversation. They have not indicated how extensive they were. They have indicated that they are going to continue, although they're not going to be at the ministerial level. So I think one can say with certainty that there was discussion, and there are discussions, and there are ongoing discussions. And there are some people in Iran who, again, see nothing wrong with trying to coordinate and cooperate with the United States. And the other thing we have to remember is that even the radicals who protest, as some of the radical conservatives are protesting against any idea of cooperation, in the past we have seen them protest publicly and then privately be completely willing to coordinate with the United States if their own interests demanded. That's what happened in 2003, 2001. This is what happened in Iran-Contra episode. So there is a history of saying one thing by the radicals in public and doing completely different thing in private.
And we gather that reprinting in Iran in Farsi of an article you wrote suggests there may be some significant internal division on the nuclear issue. Tell us about that and what you wrote.
I wrote an article with Sig Hacker, who was the head of Los Alamos, if you remember, for 10 years, and is one of the most respected nuclear physicists in America, and he's now at Stanford. And what we wrote was published in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, and what we suggested that is that if Iran really wants a peaceful nuclear program, as it repeatedly claims, there is a completely different way of going about it. They should follow the path of South Korea. South Korea began its nuclear program essentially at the same time Iran did. South Korea is now one of the major exporters of nuclear technology. They build reactors, compete with the United States and the best countries of the West in getting a bigger share of the market. And Iran has virtually nothing to show for it. In spite of all this enormous amounts of financial capital they have spent, political capital they have squandered, emotional damage they have wrought on the people. And if they look at it differently, if they realize that enrichment is not going to make them independent because they don't have enough uranium for even one reactor, they will need to import uranium anyway, then they can have a nuclear program that is a source of economic gain for Iran and a much less source of concern to the international community. And as you said, to our great surprise and pleasure, the Ministry of Cultural Guidance translated the article in its entirety and put it on their website.
Abbas Milani is Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University.
Quote from the news, "Why don't we embrace this sacred status that God gave to women?" That was Morocco's prime minister telling Parliament that women should stay home and care for families, setting off a firestorm of objection on social networks and news media.
Next, deportation consternation on the Texas border and beyond, for your ears only.
We're back for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote, "We've been waiting for 25 years. That was Youssef Salam, one of five black and Latino men, to share a $40 million payment from New York City to settle their suit for false conviction and years of imprisonment in the infamous 1989 Central Park jogger rape, delayed for additional years after their release before new mayor Bill de Blasio pledged to end the city's foot dragging. Now this.
We need to show humanity with respect to people who are working, contributing right now, and deporting them, leaving their children alone, or deporting an adolescent, doing anything that is so contrary to our core values just makes no sense. But we have to send a clear message. Just because your child gets across the border, that doesn't mean the child gets to stay.
It was for many a surprising stand by presumed Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton at the CNN Town Hall Forum in a week when immigration reform was seen as a significant factor in the unprecedented defeat of a Republican House Majority Leader, Eric Cantor of Virginia, and the selection of his replacement, Kevin McCarthy of California. That McCarthy also has not entirely shut the door on the subject, however, did not make many see real legislative action on immigration reform as likely. And it put new pressure on President Obama to take more executive action, as he had 2 years earlier with the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival programs in behalf of undocumented young dreamers.
In fact, the administration announced this week it will open new detention facilities to better house a surge of immigrant families crossing the border illegally from Central America, while also protecting those who are seeking legal asylum. But many Hispanics here, legally and otherwise, were still calling Obama the deportation president. To discuss these and related issues now, for your ears only, is Christina Jimenez, managing director of United We Dream, the largest immigrant youth-led organization in the U.S., which advocates for the fair treatment of immigrant youth and families, regardless of immigration status. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Let's focus first on the children now crossing illegally into the U.S. How many children are we talking about, mostly from where, and why are they coming?
What we are seeing at the border is a real humanitarian crisis. We have about 47,000 children that have arrived in 2014 so far, and this is a 92% increase from the numbers that have been tracked in 2013. They're fleeing violence from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador.
Are they believing correctly, obviously incorrectly, that they will be permitted to stay, or are they at least lured by reports that they're going to get legal representation if they seek asylum?
You know, what's important to understand is that unaccompanied minors, children, and moms who are very vulnerable communities fleeing the violence in Central America has been an issue that's been ongoing for years, and it has been an issue that the United States has been dealing with for many years. Now, the reason why we're all talking about the situation now is because of the high increase. But this has been happening for a long time, and there's even been, you know, many of the children that go to other neighboring countries like Panama and Costa Rica. So, you know, this is something that we have seen over the last couple of years. And for many of these young children and mothers, there are legal cases of asylum. And of qualifying as refugees, which, as you know, the United States has is known worldwide for being a country that is accepting of refugees and asylum seekers.
And how does Hillary Clinton's view on kid border crossers impact your view of her as a potential presidential candidate?
I think her remarks during the CNN interview were disappointing, and also they were contradictory. She mentioned that we, as Americans, should not be supportive of family separation. That's not an American thing to do. But at the same time, she said, you know, these children need to be sent back. And she also justified President Obama's deportation policy, which has deported over 2 million people now. And every day, our communities are seeing over 1,000 people, and that means families that are going through family separation because of these deportations.
On the Republican side, Congressman Cantor was hardly an immigration reform activist. I wonder if you see, however, that the fear that immigration is a third rail for Republicans, even with the selection of McCarthy as the new majority leader, is going to continue to impede reform efforts going forward?
I think immigration has nothing to do with Cantor's primary defeat. But I think that what Republicans have shown on the issue of immigration, it's lack of leadership and not wanting to act.
On the second anniversary of the Dreamers program that he put into place, what type of additional deportation relief and immigration reform are you asking the administration to provide by executive action?
What we are asking the president to do is for him to use his executive authority to expand affirmative relief, which will mean that something similar like the DACA program that he enacted in 2012 could be something that is expanded to keep families together that at the moment are being unfairly separated. We have thousands of families who have three, four U.S. citizen children or U.S. citizen spouse, and they are still being deported. So that is one of the stories and the cases that we're lifting up to the Obama administration to show how out of control the system is and how a deferred action program could protect those families that have ties to the United States and that have already, grow up here with their children, work here, they're a part of our communities, and they have even in some cases, family members who are either in the United States legally and or have U.S. citizen children or spouses.
Christina Jimenez is co-founder and managing director of United We Dream, the largest immigrant youth-led organization in the U.S., advocating for the fair treatment of immigrant youth and families, regardless of immigration status.
Quote from the news, "It will keep me busy." That was German physicist Johann Westhauser on promising to personally thank all 728 people involved in rescuing him from the country's deepest cavern, 3,766 feet below the Earth's surface, over 11 days, 10 hours, and 40 minutes.
Next, Oz and Ads, TV's Dr. Oz and weight loss scams, for your ears only. We have more for your ears only. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern with this quote from the news. "There were some of us with tears of joy and some of us with tears of grief." That was the lesbian Reverend Susan DeGeorge of the Hudson River Presbytery in New York after the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church USA voted to allow same-sex marriages where legal. Next day, the church voted to divest $21 million from Caterpillar, Hewlett-Packard, and Motorola Solutions, which sell equipment facilitating Israel's Palestinian occupation. Now this.
When you call a product a miracle, and it's something you can buy, and it's something that gives people false hope, I just don't understand why you need to go there.
My job, I feel, on the show is to be a cheerleader for the audience. And when they don't think they have hope, when they don't think they can make it happen, I want to look, and I do look everywhere, including in alternative healing traditions, for any evidence that might be supportive to them.
Missouri Democrat Claire McCaskill was only one of the Senate Consumer Protection Subcommittee members who grilled TV's Dr. Oz last week on the way his enthusiasm for dietary supplements is too often distorted to the point of deception, especially in the area of weight loss in our obesity-prone age. He countered that the problem was probably too much restraint on his part, not plugging specific brands for the sake of propriety, thus giving others the chance to feature his generalities in ads for products he never really meant to endorse.
The problem persists across all media, print, broadcast, and the internet, but compelling web videos may be the most pernicious. The weight loss hearing also took testimony on countermeasures by various internet giants such as AOL, Google, Facebook, Twitter, and Yahoo through a coalition called TrustInAds.org. And for more on that, for your ears only, the TrustInAds.org's executive director, Rob Harrelson, joins us now. Welcome to the program.
I'm delighted to be here.
Tell us about the kind of ad standards your member companies have, especially on these weight loss supplements.
Well, our companies have very strict policies that advertisers must comply with for all types of advertising, and these are in place to protect consumers on the web, and we go to great lengths to keep bad ads off of our platforms. For the health-related advertising, including weight loss and dietary supplements, we want to make sure that advertisers aren't marketing products with false claims or outrageous claims, some of which were highlighted during the hearing on Tuesday.
How many ads that ran afoul of those standards have actually been forced off the web, and what percentage was that roughly of all ads in that category?
Well, it's hard to say since some of the companies within the online advertising space at large don't disclose those numbers. But as an example, Google last year removed roughly 325 million ads off of its platform. Off of those ads, only a fraction of a percentage were related to weight loss and they were removed for a number of reasons, but including the use of false claims.
Are the standards applied before or just ads go online, or only if there are questions or complaints raised? Would the internet company check with scientific or celebrity sources like Dr. Oz to make sure their words actually constituted endorsement?
Well, keep in mind, I mean, our companies have incredibly sophisticated filtering systems that look for this kind of stuff, as well as numerous manual review processes before ads are actually served to users. But it becomes incredibly difficult because we have to remember that it's not illegal to sell these types of products. I can go to Amazon.com or my local CVS or Walgreens or Duane Reade, for those who are in New York, and have almost limitless options to choose from. When it becomes illegal, and a violation of our company's advertising policies, is when scammers market these products under false claims. But we look for common claims like these and are able to flag a majority of these types of ads before they're ever reach the user.
Well, beyond weight loss supplements and products, what kinds of online ads present the most frequent or serious violations of your coalition standards and consumer trust?
Well, I think it constantly changes, which makes it that much more difficult to catch. Be it weight loss, hair loss, counterfeit goods, or whatever, scammers often look to attract the largest constituencies of people as they possibly can, which is essentially why they've turned to the internet to try to sell some of these products.
How and to whom can consumers question or complain about the truthfulness of ads they see online?
Well, so each of our companies have very, very simple and easy ways for users to report suspicious ads on their platforms. And, in fact, our website, trustinad.org, has a dedicated page with simple instructions on how to do this for each company. In addition, for platforms like Facebook, a user can actually flag a suspicious ad right from the ad itself and provide specific information about that ad on its mobile platform and its desktop platform.
Your own website also has tips on how to tell which ads can be trusted, especially in the field of weight loss.
No, absolutely. I mean, we try to, again, provide useful information for consumers to make good choices, and we do that through our bad ads trend alerts. We had actually released one on weight loss scams just the day before the hearing last week. So, this is an initiative that includes very much an education component to try to educate consumers on how to make good choices online.
There are special questions about ads on social networks or using data mined from them. How can consumers really be sure that particular friends or contacts of theirs, not a Dr. Oz, really do endorse or like some product or service that they get an ad or an email about?
Well, first, our companies don't serve ads by sending emails, but some social networks do serve ads based on the likes of others within a user's particular kind of social network. And I think consumers should feel confident in what they're seeing in that respect.
Amazon is infamous around my house for an algorithm that seems to assume because I once bought a watch there, I'd be interested in at least 3 watch sales a day ever since. But last week it took a different direction with a new smartphone that can recognize products or services in which consumers are interested and direct them immediately to the proper Amazon purchase page. Is that bad news for online ads?
Not at all. I think what Amazon is doing with its new phone is incredibly innovative, and I'm actually very anxious to see it in person and use it myself. But I think the online advertising models that we have in place now will certainly continue to thrive, even as new approaches to reach consumers emerge.
Rob Harrelson is executive director of TrustInAds.org, a coalition of internet industry leaders, including AOL, Google, Facebook, Twitter, and Yahoo, working to protect people from malicious online ads and deceptive practices.
Quote from the news, smacks of big cover-up to me. That was Georgia's GOP Congressman Phil Gingrey's reading of an in-house report brought to Capitol Hill by General Motors CEO Mary Barra to explain the years of delay before recalling cars with fatally faulty ignition switches. Last week, two similar safety issues came under scrutiny at Chrysler.
Next, a very Margaret memorial, the late singer Margaret Whiting, for Your Ears Only.
A last chorus for Your Ears Only. I'm David Alpern.
I'm Catherine Herzog with this news quote, "like some kind of game in my head." That was a memory of early lyric writing by Jerry Goffin, whose later hits, principally with wife and ex-wife Carole King, included "Up on the Roof," "Natural Woman," and "Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow?" He died last week at age 75. Now this.
I'm as restless as a willow in a windstorm. I'm as jumpy as a puppet on a string. I'd say that I had spring fever, but I know it isn't spring.
The prolific singer-actress Margaret Whiting was probably the first entertainment celebrity I ever interviewed as a cub reporter for United Press International in the early 1960s. She was definitely the first cabaret artist on the original version of this program as Newsweek on Air in 1988. We met several times at various concerts and shows in the years that followed until her death in 2011. And I'm pleased to report that her life and songs will be celebrated this Monday, June 23rd, in a special tribute at the Weill Recital Hall at Carnegie Hall.
Titled "It Might as Well Be Spring," the program will include more than two dozen of the hit songs for which she was known, including some by her father, Richard Whiting, and the great Johnny Mercer, such as "Hooray for Hollywood" and "Too Marvelous for Words." The show is being presented by the Mabel Mercer Foundation, Cabaret's Keeper of the Flame, co-hosted by our frequent guest, K.T. Sullivan, artistic director of the foundation, and Margaret's daughter, Debbie. And for Your Ears Only, we're pleased to talk about the woman and her music with Debbie Whiting now. Welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your mother recorded almost every popular song worth singing from the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Did she have a favorite?
Her most favorite was "Someone to Watch Over Me" by the Gershwins, but she also had a very warm spot in her heart for "My Ideal," written by her father.
Margaret Whiting was also the inspiration for a song by her father for the famous child star Shirley Temple, though it had a pretty sticky start. Tell us about the Good Ship Lollipop.
Well, apparently Margaret wasn't really always allowed in her father's studio, but she did burst in one day with a big lollipop, and she had it all over her and her hands, and she went over, and she was about to touch the piano that her father was working on, and he said, "Get away from here with those sticky fingers and that crazy lollipop." Aha! Great title, because he couldn't think of a name of a song he was writing for Shirley Temple. And it all came together in that moment.
Did she sing a lot around the house, or was that just serious business for the stage and studio?
She sang everywhere. She sang in food stores, clothing stores, gas stations. She loved singing.
What other singers did she like to listen to and work with?
Well, over the years, in the beginning when she was at Capitol, she loved listening to Joe Stafford and Peggy Lee. Her favorite singer of all time was Ella Fitzgerald. And then as time went on and the generations changed, she loved listening to Barbara Streisand, Judy Collins and Joni Mitchell, Melissa Manchester, and Bette Midler.
She was very close to her father's sometime collaborator, Johnny Mercer, and got to sing with him as well. Did you get to see him much?
Yes, I did. And it now, looking back in retrospect, I wish I would have paid more attention, because if I would have known that all this was going on, I would have paid a lot more attention.
What about one of the other singers Mercer was close to, the famous Judy Garland?
Well, Mom knew Judy for a long time, but it was basically when they were young and both doing studio work. Judy would come over to the Whiting house all the time, and they would sing with Richard and Johnny. And every time Johnny or another one of the great songwriters had a new song, they'd come over to the Whiting house and play, and the two girls would scramble to the piano to see who was going to sing it first.
Margaret once wrote that her father's advice about performing was to sing the songs as they were written because the creators worked real hard on them. Did she ever talk about how she approached the material she did?
Well, she took great pride in singing the songs that the composers wrote as they were written. All the songwriters realized that Margaret sang the song the way it was written, so they always asked her first to be the first singer to sing their new composition.
Besides the songs we've already mentioned, what are some of the others that will be performed at the Weill Hall celebration?
Well, we have the whole idea of the show is Mother's life in song. So we start with her capital hits in the 1940s and 50s, like Moonlight in Vermont and Might as Well Be Spring. And as we move up, we go into the Jerome Kern songbook and some of the things that she did at Verve. We have a couple of duets. We have a Bob Hope duet, Ain't We Got Fun. And then as time went on and she moved to New York, she loved singing songs by the new songwriters of that day. And we're talking about the 1980s. So that would have been Rupert Holmes, Peter Allen, people like that.
Debbie Whiting will co-host It Might As Well Be Spring at 7 p.m. Monday, June 23rd, in the Weill Recital Hall at Carnegie Hall, 154 West 57th Street in Manhattan. Check it out at MabelMercer.org and MargaretWhiting.com.
And so I'm borrowing a love song.
Maggie sings Mercer and Whiting, and this has been For Your Ears Only. For Your Ears Only on Air is also online at iTunes, FeedBurner.com, Stitcher.com, and going back years at archive.org.
This broadcast was engineered by Justin Ewan at the Hanger Studio Play It Productions. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. Our show is a nonprofit project of the New York Foundation for the Arts, supported by the Gatewave.org radio reading service for those with disabilities, the Best Memorial Trust, and award-winning ACAM Associates, exceptional management, impeccable reputation for New York co-ops, condos, and condops since 1983. Learn more at ACAM.com. Pledge your tax-deductible donation to davidearsonly@gmail.com.
Now we're back with another archive segment, a major story on our show a year ago.
This week last year, we looked at a real-life crime drama playing out in Boston, the trial of longtime fugitive mob kingpin James Joseph Whitey Bulger, Jr., from our June 23rd, 2013 broadcast, hosted by Catherine and me.
Some may question my methods.
Turn around for me.
But they do work.
Mr. Bulger is going to testify about anything and everything at this point in his life. His goal is to have the truth come out regarding how he was able to act with impunity for so long in the city of Boston.
A uniquely talented actor like James Gandolfini, who died last week of a heart attack in Rome at only 51, could make the violent side of mafia life almost sympathetic as part of an everyman struggle with existence. Defense attorney J.W. Carney was far less successful last week in humanizing longtime fugitive mob boss James Whitey Bulger, captured last year and now on trial in Boston on multiple charges of murder, racketeering, and other major criminality. Indeed, many in the courtroom were mortified by the testimony of brutality and bloodshed.
In the week's other high-profile case, an all-female jury with only one non-white was chosen to decide on second-degree murder charges against Neighborhood Watch volunteer George Zimmerman for fatally shooting unarmed black teen Trayvon Martin. And the judge ruled that words the defense claimed were inflammatory, including profiled and vigilante, could be used by prosecutors, as long as the word racial was not.
To talk more about Bulger, his case, and the infamous FBI protection connection to which Carney seemed to allude last year and now denies, for your ears only, we're joined by Shelley Murphy, Boston Globe reporter covering the trial. She's also co-author of Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice. Shelley, welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
Some experts have said the FBI of an earlier era is nearly a co-defendant in this case for complicity in Bulger's crimes while it protected him as an informant. His lawyer seemed to hint at it as well, but now argues that Bulger's Irish roots would never let him snitch. What's the strategy in denying he was an informer, sort of a hero?
Well, I mean, the fact is that Whitey Bulger spent his entire life trying to cultivate this reputation as a good bad guy, a gangster with scruples. And let's face it, good bad guys do not snitch on their friends. So now he's saying this was a one-way relationship. Yes, the FBI was corrupt. I paid FBI agents for information. They leaked me information that helped me protect my criminal organization. And what he's saying is that this FBI agent basically falsified this informant report, claiming Whitey was an informant, so if they were ever seen together, that he could explain that.
Well, what's the best evidence Bulger was an informant, and will the government itself present it at trial?
Yes, on Friday, the government started presenting Whitey's informant file. The FBI has an informant file with his name on it that contains more than 700 pages of reports. Now, you know, Whitey's saying, I never told the FBI anything, but in these reports, which we've seen in prior cases, there's information about the activities of his rivals in the mafia, members of his own gang, information that clearly the FBI would not be in a position to know on their own.
It was almost a scene out of The Sopranos when one witness last week, a confessed killer, told of learning that Bulger was an informant.
And that was John Matarano. This is a man who admitted killing 20 people and says that Bulger was involved in 11 of those murders. And he says that, you know, he had his own little code here, that when he found out that Bulger was an informant, he turned on him and agreed to be a witness for the government.
He said it broke his heart.
Yeah, he said it broke his heart. Apparently, you know, he had his own, you know, strange code of honor. You know, he had no problem shooting someone in the head and then sitting down and he talked about it like you or I might talk about having a cup of coffee. And then I shot him. And yet, when he discovered that Whitey was an informant, he said this was the ultimate betrayal because he was the godfather to some of his kids. He actually named one of his children after him.
How did Bulger and his former partner in crime react to one another in court?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, Whitey Bulger sitting in the courtroom looks like this unassuming little old guy. He's 83 years old. He sits there barely looking at any of the witnesses who are testifying. Now, he had not seen John Matarano since 1982, and he did. You could see him sort of stealing glances, wanting to get a look at him and see how he looked. But there was no real eye contact. They did not engage at all.
And what was the reaction to last week's bloody testimony by kin of the victims and others in the courtroom?
Well, disgust. I mean, they're absolutely disgusted. It's horrifying for them to sit there and have to relive, you know, the murders of people they lost in the 70s and 80s, and they're devastated. But they also are just so relieved that they're finally, you know, Whitey is finally in court, you know, after 16 years on the run. They want to hear, you know, they want to hear the evidence. They want everything to come out.
What did research for your book reveal about how Bulger came to a life of crime, especially while a brother rose to prominence in politics, although many people might say there's not such a difference there? Are words like psychopath, sociopath, or monster at all useful?
Well, you know, we stayed away from labeling him, but I think what's sort of, some people have called him a narcissist, a sociopath. If you look at him, I mean, he was able to have relationships with women and families and convince people that he was a good guy. He had loving relationships. He raised, you know, his girlfriend's four children as his own, used to sit down to these dinners and preach them like father knows best about stay out of trouble, stay in school, be physically fit. So there's a lot of complexities to his life.
And what's the minimum sentence he's likely to face now as an octogenarian?
Well, I mean, he has written to a friend from jail that he expects to die behind bars, which, you know, I mean, no matter, you know, even if he is convicted of only a couple of things at his age, he will spend the rest of his life in jail. And if he is convicted of any of these murders, it will be a life sentence.
And going back to the FBI, is anybody still there likely to be affected by what this trial reveals?
You know, the only way anybody could be affected is if they were implicated in murders, which have no statute of limitations. You know, there have been many allegations about other agents taking payoffs, leaking information. But unfortunately, the statute of limitations has told. These crimes happened decades ago.
Shelley Murphy is a Boston Globe reporter covering the Bulger trial and co-author of Whitey Bulger, America's Most Wanted Gangster and the Manhunt That Brought Him to Justice.
Mafia Morality from our June 23, 2013 broadcast. On August 12th, after a two-month trial, Bulger was convicted on 31 counts, including two racketeering charges, and was found involved in 11 murders. As a result, on November 14th, he was sentenced to a pair of consecutive life terms plus 5 years and is currently resident at the federal penitentiary in Tucson.
Back in Boston, a feature film about Bulger, Black Mass, starring Johnny Depp, is being shot despite the displeasure of many local residents, not only for the impediments and distractions such projects always present, but because they fear glorification of their native son gone wrong. A documentary about the Bulger trial, Whitey, by director Joe Berlinger, focuses more narrowly on whether the FBI was paying Bulger as an informant or if he was paying crooked G-men for protection. I'm Catherine Herzog.
I'm David Alpern. We'll visit the archive again next week. Now, the Shirelles' 1960 hit version of Will You Love Me Tomorrow by Carole King and Jerry Goffin, who died last week at 75.